James gives us here four wonderfully practical, godly responses to temptation. And if you will put these into practice in your life, I can promise you, you will see a diminishing pattern of sin in your life and an increasing pattern of holiness.
Welcome to The Word Unleashed with Tom Pennington. Tom is pastor teacher at Countryside Bible Church in Southlake, Texas. Hello, I'm Bill Wright, and we're continuing Tom's series with part three of Hook, Line, and Sinker. Friend, be honest with yourself for a moment. Do you struggle daily with being drawn away by your own sinful desires? Does it feel like you're being pulled under again and again? Well, here's the good news. The book of James provides a much-needed solution to your temptation and sin problem. Not a band-aid, a solution. In God's wisdom, He gives us, through James, four godly responses to temptation. Responses we must earnestly heed if we want to break free. Today, Tom Pennington explains from Scripture how we as Christians must feel the weight of temptation and sin, and then relentlessly pursue the Lord Jesus Christ. Let's join Tom Pennington for more now, here on The Word Unleashed.
Well, it's my joy for us to return to our study that we've begun of the Epistle of James, a great little letter that reminds us in so many ways of how absolutely practical the Scriptures are to the issues of life. We began to look at a paragraph beginning in verse 13 of James 1. Look at that wonderful paragraph about the issue of temptation. A couple of years ago, I read an article about an animal rights organization and their plans to establish a national campaign against fishing. They were going to buy a series of billboards, perhaps you saw one even here in the area, that pictured a lovable dog. I forget now whether it was a golden retriever, an Irish setter. It was some dog like that, a large, lovable dog. And the dog was sitting on the billboard, you know, in the picture on the billboard, with a hook hanging out of its mouth and blood was dripping down from the hook. And the caption read, "If you wouldn't do this to a dog, why to a fish?" You know, one sportsman said something like this. He said, "Well, that's easy." He said, "Fish has never brought me my slippers." Well, I can understand being careful with the resources God has provided us in the world. That's important. We're stewards of this world. And yet, these people, in spite of their good intentions, they're coming from an evolutionary mindset, and so they have concluded that all life is equal before God. They don't understand that God has given, by sovereign purpose, animals to man for food. And in fact, He's declared now all of them to be clean and useful for human beings. And, you know, it's kind of hard to eat what you don't first catch and kill. They don't understand all of that. But as I thought about that campaign, as well-intentioned but silly as it was, it occurred to me that if you and I could see true spiritual realities, if we could see the world the way God sees it, each of us could be pictured like that dog on the billboard with a bloody hook in our lips. Because every one of us, without exception, has been tempted by a certain bait, a certain lure, and we have given in to that bait, to that lure. The Bible calls this process by which we are lured to sin, temptation. And the most thorough discussion of the issue of temptation, I believe, anywhere in the Bible, occurs here in James chapter 1. Let me just remind you of the context of James' comments. He began with the issue of trials. After one verse of introduction in verse 1, he immediately comes to the issue of trials, beginning in verse 2 and running all the way through verse 12. He's talking about those external pressures and troubles that come into our lives that God uses to refine us, to build endurance, to make us more like Christ. But then in verse 13, James transitions from those external pressures and troubles to the internal solicitation to sin, what we call temptation. And that's where we find ourselves today. Let me read for you this paragraph. It begins in verse 13 and runs through verse 18. James writes, "Let no one say when he is tempted, 'I am being tempted by God.' For God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. Then when lust has conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death. Do not be deceived, my beloved brethren. Every good thing given and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation or shifting shadow. In the exercise of his will, he brought us forth by the word of truth, so that we would be a kind of first fruits among his creatures. The key to this passage is found in verse 13, where James says, "Let no one say when he is being tempted." We're talking about the issue of temptation. We're talking about what to do, how to respond when we find ourselves in the process of being tempted. Or perhaps we have been tempted and we have fallen to that temptation. We have chosen to sin. How do we respond? What do we do? Well, James very practically outlines for us here four godly responses to temptation. Temptation is a reality that you will face your entire life. If you are a living, breathing human, you will face temptation many times today and tomorrow and the next day and every day of your life until Jesus comes back or until you die. So how do you deal with it? Well, James gives us here four wonderfully practical, godly responses to temptation. And if you will put these into practice in your life, I can promise you, you will see a diminishing pattern of sin in your life and an increasing pattern of holiness. Let's look at them together. Last time, we looked at the first two of these godly responses. Let me just sort of remind you, and for those of you who weren't here, just sort of give you a little taste of what we discussed. If you're going to respond in a godly way to temptation, first of all, you must accept full responsibility. Verse 13, "Let no one say when he is being tempted, 'I am tempted of God.'" Don't blame God. Don't blame God directly. Don't say, "God tempted me." Nor should we blame God indirectly by saying things like, "It's the wife God gave me," or "It's the parents God gave me," or "It's the circumstances into which God placed me." The bottom line is, if you blame anything other than your own sinful heart for your temptation, you are blaming God. And James says, don't do it. Don't blame God. Why? Well, verse 13, he says, because God is untemptable. Moreover, God doesn't tempt anyone. Because of God's character and because of God's pattern of behavior, don't blame God for it. Accept full responsibility. The second response that we looked at last time was identify the source. Identify the source. If it wasn't God that brought that temptation into your heart, where did it come from? Well, if you're going to deal with temptation in a godly way, you have got to identify the true source of that temptation. In verse 14, he gives it to us. Each one is tempted by his own lust. Now, as I told you last time, the word lust is often misunderstood. It's when we hear that word, we think of sexual sin, and it certainly includes that, but it's much, much broader. This word is a neutral word in the Greek New Testament. It can be used positively, desiring good things. It can also be used of desiring evil things. Most often in the New Testament, it's used to describe those sinful desires or cravings that are a part of our depravity. You have in your heart, and I have in mine, a set of lusts, that is, of cravings. It's probably a good translation of the word. Things we crave, and we want those cravings to be fulfilled. Those cravings don't go away once we become believers. In fact, it is those cravings that are a part of your heart and mine that are the root of every sinful act. Each of us is susceptible to a certain set of cravings. Notice what James says. Each one is tempted by his own cravings. There are certain things that appeal to me that don't appeal to you, and there are certain things that appeal to you that don't appeal to me. Different lures, if you will, that carry us away into sin. I talked last time about a lot of the things that we tend to crave. We can crave sinful things, but we can also crave good things in a sinful way. I mentioned the issue of the physical relationship in marriage. That's a wonderful gift from God. But to desire that outside of marriage is a sinful craving. We can control everything from approval, fame, popularity, sex, you name it. We can crave any number of things. But it's from those cravings that our sins actually come. If you want to respond biblically to temptation, you must accept full responsibility and you must identify the source from which those temptations come. Now that brings us to where we want to consider today, and that is James' third biblical response to temptation. Understand the process. Understand the process. If you want to defeat temptation in your life, then you must understand the process through which it goes. I can tell you that it was a number of years ago I really came to grips with this text and studied it for myself, and it absolutely revolutionized my own understanding of and approach to temptation in my own life. If you can master and understand the process that temptation takes, you are well equipped to deal with it. Let's look at this process. James lays out a five-stage process that begins every time we are tempted and give in. Every time you are tempted, whether you give in or not, this process begins. And if you give in, the process continues ultimately through all five of these stages. Stage one is attraction. Attraction. Verse 14. Each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lusts. In the Greek text, that order is a little differently. It literally says, each one is tempted by his own lust, being carried away and enticed. This carried away and enticed, that package, are two participles in the Greek text. If you remember your English grammar, there are participles in Greek as there are in English, typically ing type words. And these two words together describe how lust brings about temptation. And it's the language of fishing. James grew up around the Sea of Galilee. He was either a fisherman or he certainly understood fishing. And so as he talks about temptation, these two Greek words are words from the language of a fisherman. Carried away and enticed. Now it's important that you understand that that expression is what grammarians call a hendiades. You'll never remember that, but that's okay. Essentially, a hendiades is two words packaged together to mean one thing. You use one of these often, and you probably have had it recited to you. When you were growing up, if you got on your mother's last nerve, she would say to you, "Listen, son, I am sick and tired." Now, she didn't mean she was sick, and she didn't mean she was tired. She meant she was sick and tired. Two words with one package meaning, carried away and enticed. But there are some subtle differences in those words that enrich our understanding. They're two different aspects of the same process of attraction. Let's look at them together. Carried away. It means to draw out, to lure. In classical Greek, this word was used to describe the drawing of the fish out of its original retreat. You know, picture this fish. You know, he's having a good morning. He's just playing among the weeds. And something draws him out. That's the meaning of this word. It pictures the movement of the fish toward the bait. You see, this is how lust works in our hearts. This is how craving works in our hearts. It begins by drawing our minds away from their normal activity. A craving suddenly interrupts the normal, natural flow of our minds. This is the result of the cravings that reside within our heart. You're at work. You're doing your business. You're working on your computer. And all of a sudden, your craving draws you away out of that normal activity that you're doing. It comes from within your own heart. Notice the second part of this expression, enticed. Literally means to catch with bait. It depicts the juicy worm being dangled before the fish and the fish having an inner craving to eat it. You see, craving first interrupts our minds, draws us away from our normal activity, and then it presents before us a specific bait. Understand how this process works. This internal sinful craving that's a part of our depraved heart attaches itself to some external opportunity and craves to be fulfilled. Let me give you an example from the life of David. You remember in 2 Samuel chapter 11, he finds himself at home when kings went forth to battle, and there's a sermon there, but He's walking about on the roof of his palace in the evening. Nothing wrong with that. Nothing sinful about that. It's what was often done in the Middle East on a hot evening. You would go up on the roof of your house, and usually they were flat, and you could get some coolness, because often in those kind of climates, there's coolness in the evening, and you could enjoy that coolness. All's fine. He's doing his normal daily routine. But then he sees Bathsheba bathing. What happens? Immediately his internal craving attaches itself to that specific bait and lures him out to fulfill itself. This is the first stage of temptation, attraction. And it describes the work of your depravity. Listen to me. This is as involuntary as the beating of your heart. You can do nothing to stop that craving from arriving out of your heart, arising out of your heart, because it's part of your fallenness. It's part of your unredeemed humanness. It will happen all your life. So a strong desire springs forth, unexpected and uninvited, from our depravity and attempts to bait us to satisfy it. Now that desire is sinful in the sense that it is an expression of our depravity, but it's not yet a sinful choice. At this point, it is only a temptation. And by the way, this is where our temptations differ from Christ's temptation. He was tempted really and truly, but his temptation was completely external from outside of him. There was no craving in his heart that was seeking to be fulfilled in that thing as there is in us. Attraction. By the way, at this point, you can deal with temptation the best. This is when you can cut the head of temptation off, is at this point. But stage two is decision. Decision. Verse 15, then when lust has conceived. Then, the word then makes it clear that James is outlining a process here. And he changes his imagery from the language of fishing to the picture of pregnancy. He says there comes a time when lust gets pregnant. When lust conceives. Now what does he mean by that? When does lust conceive? When does this craving conceive? It's when our will no longer objects, but yields and consents. Listen to this famous medieval description of temptation, of this stage of temptation. At first, it is a mere thought confronting the mind. Then, imagination paints it in stronger colors. Only after that do we take pleasure in it, and the will makes a false move, and we give our assent. End quote. Like pregnancy, there's a gestation period. There is a time after the will consents, but before any external act. It may be a short period of time, or it may be years. But during that time, after your will consents to give in to that craving, but before you actually act, you are as guilty of that sin as if you had actually committed it. That's what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 5, verse 28, when he says, a man who looks upon a woman to lust, he's committed adultery with her already in his heart. He may not have acted on it yet, but once the will consents, then he's made his choice. When our will agrees to continue pursuing that craving in our minds, it becomes a sinful choice in the mind. This is where to stop it, before this decision is made, while it's still attraction. You can't stop your depravity from presenting itself in cravings that want to be fulfilled with some external bait. That's going to happen your whole life. But you can stop it there. As one ancient commentator said, there's no way you can stop a bird from landing on your head, but you can stop it from building a nest there. Stage three, action. Attraction, decision, action. It, that is the lust, gives birth to sin. Lust got pregnant when your will conceded, when your will assented, and eventually that lust will give birth to sin. Internal craving will eventually give birth to a sinful act. Now, this doesn't mean that lust itself isn't sin. Roman Catholic theology teaches that lust, in what it's called its first motions, that is, before the will assents, isn't sin. But we know that's not true, because we know we can sin without our wills coming into play. Just take, for example, sins of ignorance. When you and I sin without really knowing we're sinning, have we still offended the law of God? Have we still sinned? Absolutely. What James is referring to here is the acts of sin that follow sinful thinking. You see, like animals and people, every craving of your heart that you allow to conceive, to get pregnant, that is, you assent with your will and say, okay, I want to think about that some more, I want to go down that path. Every time you do that, that sin, or that sinful thinking, I should say, will eventually give birth to a in-kind sinful act. Just as if you plant an apple seed, you're going to get an apple tree. If you plant and allow to grow in your heart a craving for a certain kind of sin, ultimately you're going to express that craving with a sinful act. There's a grave warning here, by the way. A woman cannot conceive without starting an inexorable process at the end of which she will give birth to a child. In the same way, if you regularly choose to indulge your cravings within your mind, even if you've convinced yourself that you'll never act on them, and I can't tell you how many people I counsel who play with sin in their minds for years, telling themselves that they'll never carry through on it, it's a lie. James says, if you allow lust to conceive, to get pregnant, if your will assents to tolerate it in your mind, to go over it, to go down that path, to allow yourself to think about and consider that sin, whatever it is, it will eventually be born. If you have allowed by the consent of your will lust to conceive and unrepented of, it will always eventually give birth to a sinful act. Don't deceive yourself. Action. Stage 3. Stage 4 is disposition. Verse 15, when sin is accomplished. Literally, he says, when the sin is accomplished. You see, James takes up the story of the particular sin he just mentioned. When that sin that finally came from those cravings that you allowed and tolerated in your mind, when that sin is accomplished, what does he mean by that? The word accomplished means completion, maturity. Means to be full grown. It draws from the imagery of successive generations. You see, one sin gives birth to another sin of the same kind, which gives birth to another sin of the same kind, which gives birth to yet another, and so forth. And as those generations of sins build, as you commit that same sin over and over again, it becomes who you are. It becomes your disposition. It becomes your character. When sin has become a fixed habit, it determines the character of the man. As the proverb says, sow a thought, reap an act. Sow an act, reap a habit. Sow a habit, reap a character. And it finishes, sow a character and reap a destiny. This is what Paul says in Galatians chapter 6. Turn back there for a moment. Galatians chapter 6, verse 7. He gives this principle that's true in the natural and the spiritual worlds. He says, do not be deceived. Don't fool yourself. Don't lie to yourself. God is not mocked. Whatever you sow, you will reap. You put a corn seed in the ground and you're going to get corn. You put an apple seed in the ground, you're going to get an apple tree. An apple's born from that tree. It always happens that way. And it always happens that way in God's moral universe as well. Now notice his application of it in verse 8. For the one who sows to his own flesh will from the flesh reap corruption. Sows to the flesh. That means pandering to the cravings of your flesh. If you pander to the cravings of your flesh, then you will, as part of God's moral universe, unequivocally reap corruption. That is the moral decay of your character. You will become the sinful choices you are making. There may have been a time when you committed that sin, but there will come a time when you can be described by that sin. Disposition.
That's Tom Pennington here on The Word Unleashed with part 3 of his series, Hook, Line, and Sinker. Today, Tom challenged us to feel the weight of our sinful desires and showed us how to relentlessly pursue Christ when temptation pulls us away. Tom will conclude our series with part 4 next time, and you're invited to join us then. What is the proper use of systematic theology in the Christian life? In his book, The Pastor and Systematic Theology, Tom Pennington helps you understand the legitimate and illegitimate roles of systematic theology in expository preaching. Tom's book will also help Christians to rightly view systematic theologies, creeds, and confessions. Purchase your copy of The Pastor and Systematic Theology today at thewordunleashed.org. The Word Unleashed is made possible because of the prayers and financial gifts of individuals like you. Please consider partnering with us. You can find out how to do so by visiting us online at The Word Unleashed. And now for Tom Pennington and the entire team, I'm Bill Wright. Thanks for listening to The Word Unleashed, exalting God's glory, explaining God's truth.